This episode is brought to you by Mind Happy. We all spend way too much time in front of screens. I know I do, and I find myself craving creative yet restful analog activity. I never thought I would long for the downtime of my childhood in the 90s making friendship bracelets at summer camp. This is why we were so excited when we discovered Mind Happy. Mind Happy is a lifestyle and wellness brand centered on thoughtful creativity to help people craft fulfilling moments, connections, and self-care rituals through purposeful play. Mind Happy provides curated monthly deliveries that promote phone-free activities like knitting, coloring, and crafting. They believe that play is one of the most effective ways to relax and re-energize in our daily lives.
Mind Happy's founder is an ex-Amazon executive who leveraged similar activities to alleviate her own burnout. All the phone-free activities from music box building to coloring are selected based on science, restoring mental clarity, energizing connections, reducing anxiety, and facilitating fulfilling moments. It is curated monthly self-care delivered right to your door. We love that the products from each box are primarily sourced from small women-owned business. For 15% off your first month subscription, go to mindhappy.com. That's mindhappy.com and use code COURAGE15 at checkout.
Welcome to Courageous Wellness. My name is Erica Stein.
And I'm Allie French. And this is a podcast about individual journeys within wellness and how to navigate it all.
After Allie experienced a cancer diagnosis in her 20s,
and Erica went through a self-love journey, we created a platform to interview real people from all walks of life that have combined all types of practices. From physical wellness to emotional and spiritual, we hear courageous stories and focus on why it's important to share them.
We are both certified integrative nutrition health coaches, and together with our community, are learning to live our most purposeful lives by sharing one courageous story at a time.
It takes courage to share these journeys, and by talking about them, we aim to destigmatize the process. We want you to be your own health advocate, feel educated and informed on the latest in health and wellness, and empower you to feel your absolute best.
And because we want to bring forth a wide variety of stories, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect our own, but we hope the diverse and varied stories will empower you to make the best choices for your own life. So join us as we and our community share our courageous wellness.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Courageous Wellness. We have a really interesting conversation with Dr. Rob Whitfield all about breast implant illness. So I know you and I both learned a lot, and we're going to do quick updates before we get into his intro. One of the things that I have been doing is testing new non-tox fragrances, which I've been wanting to do for a long time. I've kind of used the same fragrance forever, which I love. And, you know, you get into a routine for years, but I've been doing this across different areas of my life, as many as possible, but I've kind of done one at a time, from like getting rid of plastic in my kitchen, like as far as containers go, and, you know, going to glass, that type of thing. But so my latest frontier is the fragrance frontier. And I ordered a series of these little testers to try them from Henry Rose, which is Michelle Pfeiffer's fragrance brand. They're all unisex scents, which I love. And then they're all non-toxic and use safe ingredients. And so I'm still in the test phase. It's kind of cool because they sent like 10 little ones. So, but I realize this is a funny thing about testing fragrances. You kind of have to do one a day, or like one at a time, because your nose starts to kind of blend them all together.
Yeah. So
I think I've narrowed them down to a few, but then I get confused. So I'm like, okay, Allie, just take it slower, like one day at a time, and see how you like it.
It's like after Whole30, I messed up I didn't mess up, but after my first Whole30 a few years back, you're supposed to add in like one food group at a time, mm-hmm. see how you feel. And I decided that the first day after Whole30 to like literally make a casserole with all of the foods, like an actual casserole, which I had never made before in my life. And I got so sick and I didn't know what caused it because I was like, oh, wait, I did this wrong. But I was young. I was naive. It was my first Whole30. Ali, it's so funny because I didn't know you were on this journey. And I am not, you know, on this journey, but I met up with a friend I hadn't seen in a long time and she smelled so good. Like it stayed with me and I scents are so personal, but this scent, it just smelled so good. And so I asked her what it was. I ordered it. And when you were telling me about your update, I Googled it and I was like, cause it's a little brand, it's called Dead Cool. And it's a Los Angeles based, fragrance. And so it's not like a big brand. So I was like, I wonder if it's non-toxic, and it is. So I just discovered
you are on this non-toxic scent.
I know. So it's called DED Cool. So I think that's Dead Cool, Los Angeles. Yeah. They sell it at Sephora too. That's where I got it. And oh my gosh, it smells so, I love it. It's, I think they have a bunch of different scents, but the one I got, I love, and I'm sorry, I don't know what it's called, but, because it's not in front of me.
Yeah. No, I don't know my names of mine either yet.
Well, fine. We'll do an update on non-toxic scents and share Ali's favorites from Henry Rose. And I will have the scent from Dead Cool that I bought. But you can check out the Henry Rose brand or the Dead Cool brand if you're interested.
Also, I love Michelle Pfeiffer. She's just goals, right? She's just
Michelle Pfeiffer is such goals. I have to say, though, at the peak of the pandemic, I would walk around the Pacific Palisades where I guess she lives. And
oh, no way. Have you seen her in the wild?
I would see her in the wild, and they were doing so much construction on her house. And it's just, I don't know why, but it's a peak pandemic memory. Anyway, my actual update is an update from a couple episodes ago where I talked about how I was in a Suits binge. And I started hating every character because I just watched too many. I had gotten to like season 6 and it was too much Suits. I hated everybody, even though I liked the show and kept watching it. So I just wanted to update everyone on my Suits journey that I don't hate it anymore. And, you know, I was told to just keep going, keep powering through. And I'm back to enjoying it. So if anyone needs a bingeable show, I do recommend Suits, but maybe don't binge it, because I think that just happens with any show, maybe except for SVU, as you mentioned in that update. Other than like an SVU, I feel like anytime you just binge a show and you're with these characters, you know, our episodes for 6+ seasons, they all just start to get annoying. So yeah. I'm past that slump, though.
Unless you're Olivia Benson. Thank you, Mariska Hargitay.
Unless you're...
Or Ice-T. Oh my God, yeah. He has the best one-liners too. Sorry, not to digress on SVU, which has been on for 25 years. Like, it's also on like 24/7 on every little channel.
Every channel.
Must make like a fortune in residuals. But actually, I think my friend told me that they had it at trivia one night, who are the longest running characters, I think, together on the same show, male and female. And you go to like, oh, I think it's Chris Maloney and Mariska Hargitay, but it's not, because he left the show a long time ago and now he has Organized Crime. Yes, I'm a Law and Order. I'm a Law and Order girl, but it's Ice-T and Mariska Hargitay because they've been doing it for, you know, 20 something years together.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Anyway. Lucky for them.
some perfume and content updates today, but should we get to today's episode?
Yes, let's do it.
So today we have a very timely and fascinating conversation with Dr. Robert Whitfield, a renowned plastic surgeon and leading expert in breast implant illness and explant surgeries. His work has been making a significant impact in the medical community as he pioneers comprehensive patient care for those dealing with breast implant illness.
Today, he joins us to discuss his innovative and unique approach to dealing with breast implant illness, a condition that is gaining more recognition yet leaves many patients struggling to find answers due to an information gap. We discuss the most common symptoms, key risk factors, and advice for individuals who suspect that they may be dealing with this or they're considering explant surgery. We hope you enjoy the episode. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Are you drained or bursting with energy? Is this from not enough boundaries or coming off a less social winter? It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin or dealing with feelings of burnout. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Therapy has been so impactful for me. I've been in therapy for years, and it's such an important part of my toolkit. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself and is truly for everyone. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/CWPod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CWPod.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rob. Erica and I think we were telling you a little bit before we started recording, we've never done an episode like this. So I'm really I'm excited to get into it with you today and just educate ourselves and our listeners. Just to get us started, can you share with our listeners a little bit about who you are, your background, and how you got into the world of breast implant illness?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. So by trade, I'm a plastic surgeon. I spent 6 years just doing surgical training and then 2 years of plastic surgery training and a year focused on microsurgery and reconstructive surgery, cosmetic surgery. I spent 7 years teaching at an institution, mostly microsurgery. And then in group practice, I was doing the same. I was doing microsurgery. So when I got into taking care of patients who wanted explants, there was a subset of patients who had already came to me for that issue, and that was cancer patients. So cancer patients may have a variety of reasons for having an explant. They may have had a capsular contracture and had different procedures over time, and they're still having pain, or maybe they had a radiation treatment and had a capsular contracture. So those are some common ones. Maybe somebody had different bouts of problems with infections, maybe while they were getting other treatments like chemotherapy and or radiation therapy. So there's lots of different reasons and scenarios that I was already dealing with patients who required a removal or an explant of a breast implant. So we would do an autologous reconstruction. So for the audience, we would take the lower abdominal tissue and preserve the muscle and the nerve in an operation called the DIEP free flap and use that to reconstruct the breast. So that was mostly, you know, what I was concentrated on, because I get asked a lot, do I still do implants or did I ever do a lot of implant-based surgery? And the answers are no, I don't and haven't done implant-based surgery for about 3.5 years now. And before that, I was taking care of people's cancer problems, so reconstructive issues normally, and sometimes cosmetic issues, because I had so much experience from cancer reconstruction that it was easier for me to take care of a problem usually. So I would see patients from time to time who obviously had those issues. And then I had a patient in Austin after I moved to Austin in 2012. It was about 2016. She came to me and she just wanted her reconstruction taken down. Now, I think everybody should understand that it's always the patient's preference in these situations of what they're having done. It's not for the plastic surgeon to decide for anybody what they're having done. So if the patient comes in and says, I want a flap procedure, that's totally fine. That's the patient's choice. And there's not any specific recourse other than to just help them get to the endpoint that's going to make them comfortable. So over, you know, 20 years, I did not a large amount of those, but obviously I would take care of those. And this patient, due to a pre-existing medical condition, had to be taken care of in a hospital. So so the audience understands. So when you take out the material, when you're doing that for cancer reconstruction, what I always did was very kind of consistent in protocol. I would take all the material out with the capsule around it. And the majority of the time you can take it out intact. In the social media world, it's called an in-block capsulectomy. That's referred to commonly now in groups, but it's a pathology term. It's just taking it out without disturbing it. And so we would do that. And then on the back table, when we're all done, typically you would open that material up, send cultures of both that material, pieces of that material, the implant. You don't want to miss somebody having recurrent cancer. So all this was taken into account in each case. And then we always checked for any kind of infection. So we, once again, would send cultures and sometimes small samples. And so I did that procedure. She went home, no issues. Saw her at a week to do her follow-up. And her results showed that she had no evidence of recurrent cancer, which is obviously first and foremost, always. But she did have basically an infection. And so this patient had no signs or symptoms of an infection other than she was fatigued, which, to be honest, in taking care of cancer patients over long periods of time with histories of chemotherapy and or other therapies, fatigue is a very, very common issue long-term for them. So, but no laboratory abnormalities. So they didn't have a white blood cell count that was elevated. They didn't have any redness on their examination. They didn't have any firmness. I mean, just things that basic things that you would say, oh, did I somehow miss this or go back and look again? And none of this was the case, but she had on a hospital-based system, a E. coli infection, which E. coli for everybody listening comes from typically the urinary tract or the GI tract. And so how can that happen? I get asked, well, how did that get there? So someone can have a urinary tract infection that becomes bloodborne. So it gets into your bloodstream, and that's how these things get attached to devices, heart valves, implants, hip, knee, breast, dental, whatever. Same with the GI tract. You could have a colonoscopy or you could have a diverticulum and somehow it gets infected or irritated and it gets into your bloodstream. And that's how, you know, something gets or evolves into a bloodborne issue. And that's typically how these things happen. Usually not in super healthy people would that happen, but, you know, immunosuppressed patients can have that problem. And we saw it routinely in just complex tertiary care. So I put her on an antibiotic, which is not my, I don't ever put anybody on antibiotics after surgery. That's not necessary. But this obviously dictated that because she had an infection. And I put her on that and all of her fatigue went away.
Wow.
So she had been living with a implant infection, not a problem with what we call biofilm, but she actually had an infection. And so it's reported a certain way on a report to a physician like myself, it's greater than 10 to 6 of this bacteria, and that is an infection. So that kind of obviously made me think, like, how did I miss this? My sister's a breast cancer survivor, and if anybody ever missed an infection on her, I'd be completely pissed off. So I didn't really have an explanation for why, you know, her presentation was the way it was. I think she then went on to put me on some message boards and groups on Facebook, and then I just had people start coming to me interested in explant surgery. I did those intermittently over the next couple of years until we got to basically kind of, I would say, end of year, about 18, I took care of a patient from Louisiana, and her sister lived here in Austin. She wanted to stay with her sister, have an explant with me, and recover. So we took care of her, and I took her implants out, and on the back table, just like I mentioned, we would take the scar capsule, which is your tissue, off the surface of the implant. And the surface of the implant was not ruptured, but it was incredibly slimy. And that usually means there's an infection. And so I sent everything off, just like I had for the patient I mentioned previously. At a week, nothing. After I'd went out and told the husband, I'm like, I'm sure this is infected. She's going to get better. She was an ICU nurse. They get exposed to tons of things in the ICU. So basically that was a turning point for me. I knew better. There are other ways to identify bacteria that are more sensitive and specific. And after the pandemic, everybody knows what a PCR test is because we've heard that so much. So it's a research tool, polymerase chain reaction. So the ones I use now since February of 2019 are quantitative. So they give you a number, kind of like I would said, 10 to the sixth. So 10 to the sixth is an infection. Below that, we're talking about a contaminant, and we refer to that as a biofilm contaminant. There are different types, fungus, bacteria, mycobacterium. So to date, I'm sure I have the largest series in the world of these because I've been doing them since 2019 just for what's considered breast implant illness. And we can discuss how I view that term. But that's what I do now routinely for every single patient. We send every person's capsule off for pathology because I have had incidents where patients have had cancer, and one breast cancer, one lymphoma. So it's just a, from my experience, one is too many. So if you have somebody who has an infection, you didn't take care of it properly, that's a problem. If you have somebody with cancer and you didn't take care of it properly, that is a, you know, unrecoverable event, so to speak. And I don't want to ever have any of those in my practice.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. There's so much that we want to discuss with you today and unpack, and I have so many questions to ask you. I think I mentioned a little bit before recording that I have one family member that has had a lot of health issues, and they really began after they had breast implants, right? Mm-hmm. So they were healthy, they got breast implants, and they had a lot of chronic, intense health issues in the years following. And I don't know if anyone ever brought it up that it could have been the implants until very recently, because with social media, with everything that's going on, you hear now a lot of noise that people are having illnesses and they are having their implants removed and they are healing from those illnesses. So maybe to begin, what is breast implant illness and what are some of the symptoms of breast implant illness? This episode is brought to you by Sprout Living. One of our favorite new snacks are Sprout Living's probiotic almonds. Wildly delicious and irresistibly crunchy, these are the perfect gut-healthy balanced snack. Each pack of the sprouted and activated organic almonds contain 10 billion CFUs of probiotics, 6 grams of clean plant protein, and a variety of other superfood spices and herbs that do the body good.
They're made without seed oils, which we all know are out, and the flavors. The Italian truffle is delicious, and the dairy-free cheddar cheese made with turmeric and nutritional yeast always hits the spot. Honestly, we may never have another chip again. Sprout Living also makes our favorite plant-based protein blends. My personal favorite is the coffee flavor.
If you want to try Sprout Living, you can save 20% off your entire order by using code COURAGEOUS at checkout. Visit www.sproutliving.com and use code COURAGEOUS to save 20%. Give them a try and let us know if you love them as much as we do. You can also find the direct links in our show notes.
So I try to preface it by, you know, at this point, I've done probably 4,000 consults and taken out over 1,800 implants. So just for this particular issue. So the way I view breast implant illness is it's the end of a chronic inflammatory process. So we'll just start with that. So there's acute inflammation, and that would be like if you stepped away from your desk and you tripped on something and twisted your ankle. Your ankle would swell up, and that's acute inflammation. Your body sends out a signal. It swells up. And as that heals, those signals go away. Your body stops. It's healed. Now, in chronic inflammation, the signals don't stop. And they're used to, it's, to me, there's always more than one driver of inflammation in this setting. So just like your loved one, there's going to be more than one problem with them. And it starts with a few things. And I affectionately say, you can't pick your parents and you can't outrun a bad diet. So genetically, we all have a certain capacity to manage things we're exposed to. And that's our ability to detoxify through our, basically our kidneys, liver, and skin. And so if you're loved one has problems with chronic constipation, mold exposures, can't detoxify, eats a bad diet, has hormonal imbalances, is estrogen toxic, can be from that. Getting breast implants is like pouring gasoline on that fire. So it's not so much the implant's fault, but you've now just made such a problem for them from a, you know, detoxification standpoint. Like all the patients that come from all of the United States and Canada to see me, I have a Canadian in right now. I worry about, you know, their air, their water, and their food first. Where they live dictates a lot of the problems. So if I have somebody from Texas, I think everybody has mold. Somebody from where y'all are in California, y'all have mold. Especially if you're living near the beach in one of those tiny little places that's been, you know, eight people deep for however many years. Hawaii, Florida, Puerto Rico. I mean, most of us are not built to deal with mold. We have trouble detoxifying it. So I think overall, to me, the symptoms are just chronic inflammatory symptoms of each system of the body. So the neurologic symptoms, I mean, you can have headache, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, ringing in your ears. You can have dry eyes. You can have chronic sinusitis. You can have a chronic cough. You can have difficulty swallowing. You can have chest pain, shortness of breath. You can have muscle pain, joint pain. You can have electrical type shocks. You can feel vibrations. You can have just gastrointestinal problems like swelling, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, just pain. Any intractable UTIs, problems with bacterial vaginosis, candidiasis, rectal problems. I mean, if you can think of something, skin problems are just a disaster. Rashes that make no sense. And I'll have these young people and they just come in beside themselves. They're like, I have this rash, it won't go away. Or I have this intractable UTI problem or a vaginosis. I mean, it's just, and they don't know what to do. And they've been given antibiotics and all these things. And then I take out their device, allow their, you know, I call it kind of a reset. When you do that and you take away that signal, if you understand, once you take away the signal, your body will stop.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. Cause if I'm getting this correctly, the implant is giving the signal for even more sort of
inflammation,
the chronic inflammation. And so it's going to exacerbate all the other sort of toxins that we're exposed to that we need to constantly be processing anyway, depending on where we live or how we eat or whatever the other things are that you mentioned. Yeah, that makes sense. And so I'm curious, just because I'm not as familiar with the process of implants too, is it just the having the foreign object in the body, or is it also, because you hear these like horror stories sometimes of like, are they leaking? Like, is it also the material that whatever implants these days are made with? Are those materials in and of themselves ever a problem as far as toxicity goes?
Yeah, I mean, the implant shells have several different metals in them. And, okay. You know, the thing with that is it's the same with the detox things. Like, I mean, if you don't necessarily understand the genetics, like I'm super sensitive to sulfur. So, I mean, everybody can have a sensitivity. And one of the earliest patients I ever took care of, which now when I think back, as I said, I used to take out implants that were presenting issues for the cancer patients, and I'd replace them with their own tissue. And I remember specifically somebody had just this red chest, basically like a histamine release across their chest, and they felt tightness and everything. And I said, well, this could be, you know, a sensitivity issue with the device. I can't prove that. And scarring certainly is always going to happen around a device.
Yeah.
That's what your body does.
Right.
So I tell these patients, like, I understand you got this, you know, implant-based reconstruction. You went through these steps, but I don't have a way to reverse this unless I remove it. And so I'd take out all the scar tissue and the implant material and do the reconstruction with their abdominal tissue called the DIP free flap. And then that would all go away. Sometimes it'd go away on table, meaning at the time of operation. So everybody has a certain amount of ability to methylate. A lot of people have heard of the MTHFR gene. Mm-hmm. Other aspects of it have to do with how you manage sulfur. And some of that's with your COMT and FUT2 genes. So there's lots of things from a genetic standpoint that are a little bit, now when I hear them, you know, if your loved one comes to me and gives me their story, I hear their genetics more than I see, you know, physical findings, because they're not always physical findings. And that's one of the problems with this is it doesn't jump out there and go, I have a red swollen breast. It's infected. Please take me out. Now, if it did, no one would have an argument with it.
Right.
Because there aren't those physical findings of infection. It's very, very hard to make the jump for the providers, having been in that position, to say, hey, this is the way this should be done. But I don't approach it that way. I just listen. And if I already, for instance, I was on a call with somebody from Puerto Rico, and they're trying to figure out their health issues. They happen to be a physician. And they're like, hey, I have this problem. Da, 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 da. I already think they have mold. Well, too many hurricanes. You're living in a place. You don't even have to tell me. I'm just going to wait for you to tell me, because I'm going to ask you some questions. So I'm going to say, can you drink wine from America? And they're like, no, I get sick. I'm like, okay. Do you drink a lot of coffee? Oh, yeah. Where's your coffee from? Oh, it's growing over at the field next door. And, you know, we dry roast it. Da, 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 da. So two big reasons people get mold exposures are red wine and coffee. Okay. If you're sensitive to it, you're going to react to it. It's going to make you not feel well. You know, I don't want to say you're going to, you know, get an upset stomach, but you don't feel well. And it's not like when someone who doesn't have alcohol dehydrogenase, like many Asians don't have enough alcohol dehydrogenase, they turn bright red when they drink.
Yeah.
They're not breaking it down. This is a totally different problem. This is how much ochratoxin is in the wine. So if you drink, anybody who's went to Europe and had Chianti in Europe versus Chianti here knows the difference. Anybody who's had an Australian wine versus American wine. So it's on the back of a wine bottle here, doesn't tell you jack about what's in it. Yeah. But in the European Union, they have to. And there's very limited amounts of ochratoxin they can put in it.
Yes, I am someone who's experienced that. And when I stopped, I really took a break from drinking, well, pretty much all alcohol here. But wine is, and my in-laws live in France. I can go to France and enjoy wine a little bit, a lot of it, doesn't matter. Wake up feeling great the next morning. Here, I can't, at this point, I can't even finish more than a couple sips without feeling pretty terrible. And
dry farm wines.
And I don't drink it anymore because it just doesn't feel good. But it's so interesting that when like that sulfur or the sulfites that are put in it or any of the preservatives, as you mentioned, even the ones that they export from Europe are different than the ones that they have there. So it's really interesting. And that kind of shows a good, just like a good example of like how our bodies, based on where we live, based on what we're exposed to, all and based on our genetics, I guess, all process things differently. Just quick, I wanted to ask, you were talking about reconstructive, because Erica and I were talking about this prior to interviewing you as well. Reconstruction, because we're like, you know, sometimes breast implants are not a cosmetic choice. Sometimes it's cancer. Sometimes someone's transitioning and they want, you know, it's like there's different reasons to get them. And so I'm curious. So oftentimes breasts are rebuilt or built with tissue rather than using an implant. Is that what you're saying as far as cancer goes, reconstruction?
Oh, the common method in this country is still implant based, because every community should have a plastic surgeon who can do that for them. Mm-hmm. I worked in a tertiary care center. So in big urban centers, like you're in LA, so you have UCLA, they have a big microsurgery program. Every big city will have that. But as you, our country's too big, basically. As you get further and further away from the centers, you're going to have less and less in terms of options and more implant-based reconstruction, if you will. And there'll be a bunch of people who just, it's a very complicated emotional time where a lot's being thrown at a patient and they're just trying to find and process this, what they can and get taken care of. So many times when they got to see me, I was the very last person. And they've been, you know, told about the diagnosis, the chemotherapy plan, potentially radiation therapy plan, how long, survival. And then now they're like, and you need to go see Rob the plastic surgeon now. And I'm supposed to, in, you know, 30 seconds, solve all these issues and give them, you know, the best aesthetic result, you know, that we can provide for them, not knowing exactly what their treatment plans will be, because they will vary based on their surgeries and outcomes from pathology. So I didn't do a lot of implant-based reconstruction because my niche was to do the other. So I don't, and wasn't compelled ever to, you know, get a big clientele of implant-based reconstructions or patients, but people would come to me. Or if I did like the cancer patient I would take care of, and they'd say, oh, well, Dr. Whitfield did mine, you know, and they may have a daughter who needed something. That was more likely to be my patient as a direct referral versus, you know, as, you know, someone coming in.
So since, like, it sounds as if you are already dealing with inflammation or some sort of health issues. And I think what's hard about this, sorry, not to go off on a tangent, is you mentioned this too earlier, is that I think a lot of people are unwell, but they don't realize they're unwell because being unwell is so common now, right? Like having skin irritations or not going to the bathroom every day or this, that, and the other. I mean, even in our practice, the first thing we ask people is like, do you go to the bathroom every day? And it's shocking.
Normal not to.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with clients who are going maybe twice a week and their medical doctor is like, but it's fine. And like, that's not fine. Right. So I think, right. So I think what's interesting in this conversation, right, is I think it would be easy if you're like, well, if you're already dealing with inflammation or certain health issues, you're probably not a prime candidate to have an implant surgery because that's just going to make things worse. And a lot of people live with like low grade illness that they might not even be aware of because it's so normalized in this country to be fatigued, stressed, anxious, whatever it may be. And I'm sure there are people listening who maybe have implants or might want to get implants one day still. Is there anything you can do to prepare your body if that's a route you want to go? Or at this point, with everything you know, do you just not recommend it at all?
So I get asked all the time, can I sort this? And or I get put on the spot, you know, would you let your wife get implants? That's always a nice one. People try to get me at dinner parties with that. Or what if your daughter wanted breast implants, Dr. Whitfield? I'm like, okay. So what y'all need to know about me and your audience included is I'm a Leo. Very hard to tell me anything. So is my daughter.
We love astrology on this podcast. So. Yeah, I love astrology. Libra right here. Leo Venus. So speaking my language, go ahead.
So my daughter is Leo. I mean, I can give her all the I know her genetics. I can tell them blue in the face what to anticipate. And then you have to decide, right? You can't tell an 18, 19, 20 something anything. They're going to do what they want to do. So, you know, all I can do is tell you and share with you what I know. If your genetics are poor, if you eat terrible, if you live in a moldy environment, if you got bad hormonal problems to start with, you don't poop, probably not the right idea. It's not that complicated of an equation. Like, that's a lot of things that don't go well already. So just to put a prosthetic device in there, hip, knee, breast, dental, doesn't make a lot of sense, including IUDs. Not a big fan for those either.
Thank you for sharing your opinion on that. And I'm curious, Two, as far as the recovery process for explant surgery, you mentioned that sometimes you see kind of symptoms go away in the moment, the moment they're taken out. But just kind of on average, if someone's interested in explant surgery or perhaps can relate, maybe has implants and can relate to some of what they're hearing today, and that's of interest to them, what can sort of be expected as far as the recovery process?
Well, that's a good question. And for a long time, we did surgery and then watched them recover and try to get a gauge of that. Now, everything we do is really proactive. So I wrote a book about a recovery program that we utilize, but it's basically integrative testing with genetics and analysis of hormones, gut microbiome health, food sensitivities. And then we have a liposomal-based set of supplements so that we can avoid absorptive issues to the best of our ability. And I get them on that early while we're checking out to see if they have other problems, because you don't want to have to react to what's going on. You want to be well ahead of what's happening. So in the age of social media, there'll be people who feel better and look better the next day, which seems remotely kind of odd after surgery that you would feel and look better, but some people do. Now, in my experience, about 30% have that bacterial contamination. So it makes sense they would feel better because you're removing that. If you have a damaged leaking device, if you remove that, they should do better. If you have an overtly infected device, if you you remove all that, then they should do better. So those are like my wake up that whole next day, next week, they're fine. I have people in Austin about a week normally because I have a hyperbaric chamber. I have a lymphatic masseuse, a lymphatic massage device, thermography, red light therapy. I have all this stuff in my office. So we just take care of that in-house. And then as you check on them, we look at a month and then really 3 month intervals. By 90 days, that third month, you'll see quite a bit of people doing markedly better. And then it varies, like how much buy-in you get for them on their diets, supplements, and then how really difficult is their environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If they're going back to an environment that's not good from a psychological standpoint or from just a quality of like air, water, food, I mean, it's always going to be difficult. So I try to get people to be here for a period of time where I can micromanage everything I can for them around the time of surgery. Because if things start well after surgery, they tend to go well.
Yeah.
Now, once you get home and the stress of being home and or the, provider, homemaker, childcare, whatever that looks like, work all the time, people just run themselves ragged. All they can do is ask me like when they can go back to doing XYZ. And if you don't take care of yourself, it doesn't matter how good I do something.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to undo it.
Yeah. At a certain point, it becomes in the individual's hands. It's really interesting. And I guess I have just one little question about aesthetic after explant surgery. Like if you've had implants for a long time, you do explant surgery. I mean, you're a plastic surgeon, so I'm assuming that there's some sort of aesthetic that's created that to look relatively natural for the body. But how does that work as far as scarring post-explant?
Yeah, we've worked really hard to accommodate requests of simultaneous fat transfer. And so your audience should know that fat transfers should work extremely well in every given situation. It's your own genetic material. So self to self. So it always should work. The things that undo it are just what we described. You've exceeded your capacity to detoxify, right? So your body's dealing with so much stuff. Your liver's backed up. You don't poop. Your hormones are out of whack. You're eating bad. So is that person a good candidate for fat transfer? Nope. So I don't need to operate on anybody. I'm booked out 7 months for surgery now. So all I want is people have the best outcomes possible. So we'll put them in a program and counsel them on, I have a nutritionist on my staff, detox practitioner. And we want to get everybody understanding what you've been describing is like, you have to, your body has to work in order for anything I do to it to work for you. So if I do an explant and they want a fat transfer, they run through our program because I want to do that for them, but I just want to do it in the safest possible manner so they get the best outcomes. So if someone has typically, you know, they get implants early in life because they don't have a lot of volume and that's why they got an implant. So later in life, if they're seeing me to get them removed, they've typically, like we all do, we've gained weight. And in usually in areas we don't want weight. So I try to make it a win for everybody. And if you're a size 4, I try to make you a 2. If you're a 2, I make you a 0. Today, this week, I did a bunch of 0 to -2. So the point is you reshape the hip, thighs, the waist, really, to change those ratios because the breast size is going to go down. You take that fat and then you add that back in the right space, which is beneath the skin, but above the breast tissue that's there. And then I do a variety of lifting procedures, and it just varies depending on the breast and what's needed. A wide, wide breast needs to be vertically lifted. A breast that's really not low set or wide, you can do it with a little circular lift if that's what they need. And then some people don't need a lift at all. It all varies by patient, but I want to provide as much offset at one time. So from a psychological perspective and an emotional, because it is a big emotional change. And I'll do this too. There is so much nonsense written about things that implants in general, like they say implants have a bunch of mold. Like I can tell you they don't. I've had a handful of cases out of 1,000 have fungus. That's what mold is. It's a fungus. So that's a hard no. And they say saline's the worst about that. That's also no. So you just got to debunk stuff that's written or talked about in these groups because these groups don't know anything in terms of, I mean, and they always love to persecute me on these groups, which is, it's fine. So when I publish things, you know, on purpose, or when I talk about it on my show on purpose, it's to make sure that people get information. And the thing for this is if you had a saline implant, I refuse to operate on people with large saline implants until we deflate them. And the reason being is it is such a harder operation for the patient to go through because a saline implant is a non-compressible water balloon until it's popped. And I can do it sterilely in the office, and then you will see exactly how much tissue there is to you know, 95% certainty, basically. And then that helps you visually understand what's going on. So, and if people, not everybody can come here. I totally understand that, but I'm just telling you best practices. Now, if it's absolutely silicone, I can't do anything about it. I got to take it out at one time and you let me do what 27 years of experience has to do for you and take care of it. Mm. That's it's, you know, I had a patient just this week. I did her mom's cancer operation. She said she shadowed me as a high school student, which I honestly don't remember. And then I did her augmentation because she had a discrepancy from development and it really bothered her. So as I always did, and I always recommended smaller type devices, and to change her and make her more even, I put 2 small saline devices in, one 200, one 266, because I still have the record when she told me the date back in 2009 that I did it. So that's easy for me to take care of.
Yeah.
She'll come out here. I'll deflate them. She has over time, like I just said, gained weight around the waist typically, because that's what we do. I'll take the love handle area fat out. I'll transfer it. And it'll be a nice result and it'll work. It'll be durable. And it's really, that's not a win-win, but the device is out and there's some reshaping performed, and then it's not in her head for the rest of her life that she has to worry about a device or have another issue. And, you know, a lot of people have enough things to worry about that they want that off the list.
Yeah, of course. Of course. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm curious too, because you mentioned, right, not everybody can come visit you, and right, some people might be listening to this and right, maybe it's because as Ali mentioned, they're transitioning or they've had cancer, like maybe they are still attached to their right. breast implants and they're listening and they're like, I think I have some of these symptoms, or I think a loved one has some of these symptoms. Is there anything that you, and you kind of talked about it throughout the conversation, but maybe just to kind of give some tips for anyone listening, is there anything they can start doing that you recommend to reduce that inflammation, to kind of improve their quality of life, even if they decide that they want to keep their implants?
Well, fortunately, now we have enough experience with both out-of-state clients who need time for logistics. So we've seen what treatment does for them pre-op. We already know our program lowers inflammation. So our heart program can be ran remotely and they can participate in testing. They can be followed up by our detox practitioner. And so many patients are just doing that because they can't get to Austin, or they, for the time it takes, because I'm pretty rigid now about staying here. It's just, if you're going to, put the effort to come here, then put the effort to stay here and get taken care of the way I take care of people. That's my program, and I'm not going to apologize for it. I think it works the best if you can be here with me. So if you can't and you have to have surgery somewhere else, you can still run our program remotely, but you're going to be hard pressed to find all the different elements I have to take care of people in an office. Like I said, I have a hyperbaric chamber. I have a German lymphatic massage device you wear like a pair of pants. We have thermography that we do for our patients, and we have red light therapy and IV therapy and peptide therapy. Whatever therapy there is, I typically will have it if I feel it's, going to help in your healing journey after surgery. So, but for testing, supplementation, we have all that and can be ran remote. And on our side, it's the HARP method, which is my recovery program.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And thanks for sharing your expertise with us today. And just as we wrap up, we ask all of our guests three quick wrap up questions. Sure. So the first one is, you are obviously a busy doctor and booked 7 months out. How do you take care of yourself on a daily basis? And do you have any non-negotiables in your self-care practices?
Yeah. So recently, to get out of the 7 months, we started my schedule adding cases on a Wednesday and Friday, which I did not do for a long period of time. But to help patients get seen and taken care of, I've added days back into my calendar, which is not great for my neck or back, but it helps patients get taken care of. So the things that I try to do for myself is I'll go in my hyperbaric chamber as often as I can during a week. And I'll do our lymphatic massage device as often as I can during the week. And I take our supplements, and then I work out as often as I can in the morning, but I get up at 4 a.m. So I have to do things relatively early. And then really my favorite thing is to go away with my wife on vacation. Our kids are older now. We're not as fun, so they don't want to hang out with us as much, but that's okay.
Well, thank you for sharing that. The next question we always ask is, what does being courageous mean to you?
Yeah, I think in general, if you do what's right, not what's convenient, you're being courageous. Most people don't want to do that anymore because it's not convenient.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And then the final question is, do you have a book recommendation? It can be on any topic that just has meant something to you and you'd want to refer to our audience.
Metabolical. By Robert Lustig. It's probably the most informative thing about big pharma and big food that you could ever read.
Thank you. I don't think we've had that before. So that's
you should have Robert on as a guest. He is phenomenal.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And thanks again for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Courageous Wellness. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode featuring a different guest each week. Subscribe, rate, and write us a nice review. And you can also follow us on Instagram at Courageous Wellness or get in touch via our website, www.courageouswellness.net, where you can also find additional info about our health coaching services, virtual group events, newsletter, and more.
Until next week, I'm Allie.
And I'm Erica, and we're Courageous Wellness.